Welcome, I'm Jackie Persons. I'm director of the Cognitive Behavior Therapy and Science Center, which is a small group private practice in Oakland, California. And I'm also a clinical professor in the psychology department at UC Berkeley. I'm here today with Professor Ed Watkins. Professor Watkins is professor of experimental and applied clinical psychology at the University of Exeter. And I think the fact that he's professor of both applied and clinical psychology is very much tied to why we've invited him to do this interview with us. He does both basic research and clinical applied research, and he's a clinician. And so the work he's doing is very directly relevant to clinicians, and that's one of the key reasons we are talking to him today. In addition to the research on rumination that we're going to talk about here today, Ed also studies diet and behavioral change to prevent depression and obesity, the use of e-therapies to prevent depression and anxiety, and the use of innovative trial designs to disentangle the active ingredients of internet-delivered CBT. He has been funded by the Wellcome Trust, the UK Medical Research Council. He received a European Commission FP7 Award and a NORSAD Young Investigators Award. He won the British Psychological Society's May Davidson Award in 2004 for outstanding career contributions to the development of clinical psychology. And he's a member of the UK NICE Guidelines Review Board for Adult Depression. Thank you so much, Dr. Watkins, for giving us your time here today.
Thank you, Jackie. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So I'm meeting with Dr. Watkins as part of the series titled Translating Science to Practice that is hosted by and developed by the Society for Science of Clinical Psychology. The goal of our series is to help clinicians access and use findings from the scientific literature to guide their clinical work. And we're here today to talk about Dr. Watkins' work on rumination and depression. And I will tell you from my own clinical experience that in the last year or two, learning about rumination and learning strategies to target in clinical work has made a huge difference in my clinical work. So I want to thank you, Ed, because I know you are a huge contributor to the research and clinical developments in this field. I'm reading your book now. It's titled Rumination Focused Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Depression, published earlier this year by Guilford, and I'm finding it extremely helpful. Before I begin my discussion with Dr. Watkins, I want to ask listeners to, after you listen to this interview, if you'd be willing to complete a very brief survey located on the same page as this interview, that would be helpful to us as we develop this series for clinicians. So Ed, I want to focus our discussion today on your article published in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology in 2014 titled A Habit Goal Framework of Depressive Rumination, co-authored by the late Susan Nolan Hoeksema. And we will be posting some kind of access to this article to our listeners on the SSCP website. So could I ask you to start by giving us a brief summary of the habit goal framework that is described in your article?
Yeah, certainly. And I guess I want to start also by acknowledging Susan's role in that paper. It's quite a important paper, both for the theory, but also because it ended up being the last piece of work that we did together before her untimely demise. So it's sort of there as in honor of Susan as much as anything else. I guess the essence of what we were trying to do with that paper is reconcile two different views that there are in the literature about what happens with rumination. So there's Susan's original view that in depression it's a habitual response style that people do automatically that can make them feel worse. But there's also a very strong literature and evidence in the more cognitive psychology framework that rumination is something that is a naturally occurring process when people's goals aren't met. So there's this idea that it's a normal process to ruminate, to dwell on things when they don't go your way, when you have something unexpectedly go wrong, when there's a loss. But there's this idea, there's this normal process that's a state rumination that everyone has. But then for some people, there seems to be this more problematic form of depressive rumination where people get stuck. And what we were really trying to do is, because both seemed equally valid approaches from both the phenomenology and also the science base, and see, is there a way that we can actually link the two? And so I guess the key idea we came up with was that whilst it's normal enough because of cognitive mechanisms that if you've got something that hasn't gone right, if you've got a goal that you would like to be making progress on and you haven't, perhaps because of a loss, such as you might have in depression, that one will keep thinking about that issue until it's in some way resolved. It may also be that if that process happened again and again and again in a consistent context, you might then start to develop the conditions in which you could have stimulus response associative learning, whereby that context becomes enough to trigger the response of thinking about things over and over again. So it can go from something that is happening as a goal-driven process, which is normal and might happen for everybody under the right circumstances, to something that becomes a more habitual process that is less controlled, is more automatic, as we've seen depression. And in particular, that might happen if there's a tendency, if that tendency to respond in a ruminative way happens, a sad mood over and over again. And in particular, we made the distinction about how that could move away from problem solving if people are thinking about the situation in a more abstract and more passive way.
Okay. So let me see if I'm going to summarize this briefly just to see if I got it. So there's this one literature on rumination is a normal process in response to when your goals don't get met, and it's a kind of a state process. And then there's Susan Nolan Hoeksema's literature suggesting that rumination is a habit, and it's a response to often triggered by negative mood. Is that right? And so what you're trying to do is to reconcile and tie these two literatures together, and so then we get the idea that in depression we often have a normal process that's gone awry where rumination may have become habitual and cued by certain stimulus conditions in the environment.
Yeah. And the argument would be that, you know, we all are going to ruminate some of the time, and that's going to be a normal process when things go wrong or we have unexpected events in our lives, and I think we see that.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes in depressed people you get both. You sometimes have, they are ruminating because something has happened to them.
Uh-huh.
But they're also ruminating about more everyday things that other people aren't ruminating about. So there's a mixture of ruminating to a loss and an unresolved goal and this more habitual process. And the argument we made is if the goal-driven rumination kept happening and it was contingent to the same stimuli, in this case feeling sad, then that becomes, through associative learning, can become a trigger for it. And that would be particularly the case under certain circumstances. And they happen to be the same circumstances that often you see people at risk for depression, which is the kind of situation where you would often have lots of unresolved goals. So you're experiencing difficulties, adverse events, trauma. Because the more that happens, the more likely you are to get that pairing of sad mood and repetitive thinking. And that, particularly if that's combined with a reduced repertoire of coping skills, whether that's through learning experience or modelling from parents or other factors, so that you're then more likely not only to have sad mood followed by repetitive thinking, but that repetitive thinking tends to be of the more abstract, over general, why did this happen to me type, rather than problem solving. And under those circumstances, then the habit of depressive rumination would develop. And indeed, that's what the data seems to suggest, that people who've had histories of abuse or neglect are much more likely to be ruminators, for example.
Very interesting. Now, you just said about five things I want to follow up on, but before I do that, let me ask you, if you were going to think about the three main take-home messages that you would see as important for clinicians to take away from your article, what would you suggest they are?
Yeah. So I think there's three kind of interleaved key messages. So I think the first message would be what we just talked about. So rumination can be both a normal response to goals, so we should need to normalize it with people when it's that context, but it can also become a mental habit.
A problematic habit.
Yeah. So that's the first message. And then the second two messages follow from the idea of it being a mental habit. So there's a number of things that come from a process being a habit. It's cued, it's automatic, it doesn't take effort and resource, it's hard to control, it's hard to change, it doesn't respond to just telling yourself it's not a good idea. And linked to that, there are two possible ways to change the habit in an effective way. And they are, and that would be the third message. So that would be,
okay,
you can change a habit through stimulus control. You can take away or alter the cues to the habit, or you can effectively try and learn a new habit on top of the old habit and replace the habit. And of course, that requires certain things in terms of identifying the trigger and then repeated practice of an alternative. And that obviously has huge implications for what one might do clinically.
Yes, yes. So three main messages. One is that rumination can be both normal, so that we might want to normalize it with our patients, and it can be a problematic habit.
Yeah.
The key idea, second, that rumination can be viewed as a habit, which means that it's cued, it's automatic, no effort, and it's not so easy to change either. And we could say more about that. And then you're saying the key points about the key two ways to change rumination or the habit might be to through stimulus control to remove or change the cues, or to train a new habit.
Okay.
So could you say more about both of those, both the stimulus control piece to change the habit and the counter conditioning, I believe, is another word you're using to train a new habit.
Yeah,
so help the clinicians do that.
Yeah. So, I think in essence, the approach that's particularly helpful for trying to work towards both of those is something that, you know, is already well established in cognitive behavioral interventions, though to different degrees of emphasis, and that's really to do functional analysis. So you sit down with an individual client and you look at when they ruminate and where they ruminate and under what context they ruminate, and then you can start to look at when it does happen and when it doesn't happen, and you can start to map out what might be the antecedents or the triggers to it. And that then gives you the option to think about stimulus control. If those antecedents or triggers are amenable to environmental control. So to give you some examples, often people report ruminating in particular places or particular times of the day or a particular part of their day routine. So two obvious examples of that are lying in bed in the morning before getting up and lying in bed before getting to sleep, and in fact impairing getting to sleep. And so identifying that and then making a change in someone's routine, what they do at that point, could be one way to interrupt that.
So then with the person who's lying in bed ruminating in the morning, we might suggest that they get up instead of doing that. What about lying in bed at night? They could listen to a relaxation or some other kind of audio recording to give a different mental concept. What do you think?
Yeah, we could do that. I mean, I think that I would probably start with some pretty similar, as part of stimulus control, we might be doing some sleep hygiene type work. I mean, so the whole idea that they may already have built up an association between getting into bed and their thoughts getting activated. So I think one of the reasons why some of the simple stimulus control mechanisms for sleep might work quite well, for insomnia work quite well. So the idea, you know, if someone's lying in bed and they've not got the sleep within a certain point of time, they get up and go somewhere else and do something until they feel sleepy again, and then go back to bed and repeat until they fall asleep quickly. I mean, that's working on the same principle of interrupting the link between being in bed and being awake, or being in bed and ruminating.
Right.
So that's a simple thing we should do, but we might also, build in alternative strategies for that person, like relaxation or focusing their attention on something else as well.
Yes. Could you say more about repetitions and repeat the need to get a lot of repetitions in order to learn a new habit and help us implement that clinically?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the key ideas that comes up from the habit change is that you need to do two things. One of them is obviously you need to have repeated, you need three things really. You need repeated performance of the alternative behavior that you want to replace. So instead of ruminating, something incompatible to rumination that's helpful and doing that again and again and again, you also need to make sure that's contingent to the same stimulus cue. So it's not just that I practice being active or problem solving, but I'm doing that to whatever may be the idiosyncratic triggers or cues that I'm about to ruminate.
I see.
Which could be mental, it could be certain thoughts happening, or it could be physical, it could be starting to feel tense or alert, or thoughts starting to feel unfocused, or whatever it might be for an individual. They practice that. And then we need it to be reinforcing. So we need the change the habit. So the new behavior has some functional benefit. Either it's functionally replacing the original rumination, so it's getting some of the same payoff, or it's in itself helpful to someone, making them feel better. Because it's that cue routine and reinforcement are the key things to build a new habit.
So to build a new habit, we have to pay attention to training the new habit. Say you were going to do active problem solving, or you were going to do focus on your breath, or you were going to do listen to music, which is one of my patients does this while she's jogging. So instead of ruminating, now she listens to music. So you're saying one of the things that's important, which I had not quite fully grasped, was it's important to train the new habit in the same stimulus situation is the one that prompts the rumination, because we're trying to train it up so that the stimulus situation now prompts the new habit, not the old rumination.
So I mean, in that sense, it's counter conditioning a new response to the original stimuli with the view that becomes the habit, so that after a while, when they're in that situation and that difficulty comes up again, or that stimulus, or so they start feeling stress or whatever it is, the alternative response is more likely to happen automatically than the rumination. So that there's a new habit there.
Yes.
But that requires quite a lot of repetition, particularly if the rumination is fairly well entrenched as a habit. So you have to keep doing it again and again. And we emphasize that to people when we talk about habit, and I think there's actually some benefits to talking to clients around the construct of habit in itself, because everyone understands it, what a habit is. It's seen as a less stigmatizing thing to talk about than some other constructs we might use, and it also implicitly and more explicitly you can make clear to people it's not going to change overnight. If you say we're working on a habit, people get, okay, I'm going to have to work at this.
Right.
So what we would do is we typically identify the trigger, and then we'd practice doing something different to it, and ideally we'd practice that in the session, so we'd do a real live kind of practice so people got a sense of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if the trigger, which is quite common, is physiological arousal, early signs of anxiety are often quite good triggers, so heart rate going up, feeling tense, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Example, we might do something in the session to induce that feeling, for example recalling a previously stressful situation, and when someone has that feeling, we would then practice doing the alternative thing other than ruminating, which could be working through a structured form of problem solving. It could be trying to switch the focus of attention outwards onto something more constructive.
Mm-hmm.
It could be relaxation. It could be a range of things, which we probably choose so it's something that's already in the person's repertoire, so we know they can do it, and that we conceive probably going to be more reinforcing for that person, so they're going to get some sense of control from doing it. And then we practice it in the session, and typically we would record it on audio, so that we can give that audio to the person and say, hey, practice this, listen, schedule that to practice. So we're getting them to schedule the practice of making the link between the stimuli and the response. But we'd also make what we would call an if-then plan, which is similar to the track idea in behavioral activation, whereby you explicitly make a plan where you say, if I notice the certain stimulus happening, I'm noticing I'm getting tense out in the world, then I will do this, and here's the plan I'm going to do. And that would be another form of homework. We're effectively trying to get people to do scheduled practice to make the link, but also practice as it emerges in the day-to-day world, as a way of trying to strengthen the sort of ecological validity and generalizability of the learning. And if you get people doing that for a couple of weeks, if they're quite a common ruminator, they are probably going to have multiple examples of that coming up a day. So over a few weeks, you potentially get quite a lot of practice in if someone's being positive about trying to do it.
So let me ask you this, because I'm not quite clear. So when the person is practicing, they're not just practicing the new behavior, like the relaxation strategy, or the focus on the present and the environment and do something productive. They're practicing actually experience the cue and then practice.
Yeah.
Then,
whether that's us deliberately making the link in a kind of behavioral activation way, where we kind of give them a mood challenge and then do the practice like we would in the session, and then they go off and repeat that from audio, or whether it's making that link in their day-to-day responses. So we explicitly make a plan. If I notice, then I do this.
Then I'll do it. So that's the taking use of spontaneous cue presentation to practice the new skill and then link, so they get linked up together. In addition to doing that, we might have the person do exactly what you just did in the session, which is we're going to explicitly elicit the cue. We're going to present the cue. We're going to tighten up or think about something from the past that's going to make us tighten up and feel anxious.
Yeah.
That's the cue. We're going to explicitly elicit that, and then we're going to practice the new skills so they get linked together. That's what happens in the explicit practice. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's very much taking on board this idea that we're not just trying to train a new response, we're trying to train a response to a particular context.
Right.
And we need to very explicitly do that. And that makes a lot of sense from kind of, if you think about conditioning theories and so forth. And maybe, that sometimes happens in when people are doing cognitive behavioral therapy, but maybe we're just being a bit more explicit about it when we're trying to get people to do that in their practice here. All with the view that this is actually going to help change the habit and make it more likely that over time the habit itself will change.
Right. And so we have this habit idea, so that means a lot of practice is needed. How many times of practice, how many repetitions are you thinking are needed to give the person some chance of having this habit be changed?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say for sure, because I think there's quite a lot of individual difference here, and it's quite hard to quantify exactly how much practice people have done when we've done face-to-face therapy. I mean, the literature on habit change in other areas suggests that it's the sort of 60 to 100 repetitions is where you see the automaticity of the new habit reach an asymptote, so you don't get any better at it. Now, whether that's enough to get a habit that's workable, because that's when it just balances off, and maybe you need less to get a habit that's workable, and if we've got quite salient examples like the memory of, oh, I felt sad and then I did this different thing, and I've got an explicit rule with an implementation intention, if I notice this, then I do something else, then it might be we can get to that effect with fewer practices. But at this point, that's kind of an empirical question, and we probably need to do more research on actually investigating that. And when we started to collect more data in some of the studies we're doing on how automatic and how habitual these responses are. So when we go back into that data, we'll be able to start to mine it a little bit and see if we can get some sense of how many repetitions are needed. But the sense is that when people start telling us that it's changed as a habit, because they start saying it's becoming more automatic, that I'm doing these different things, that really does start to feel when we're making progress.
Yes, yes. Now, one of the interesting things about the new learning that you talk about in your article is the degree to which it's highly context dependent. Is that accurate?
Well, that would be the argument from the general habit literature and the general associative learning literature. We haven't really tested it so much with the rumination.
I see. But expecting that based on the other literature.
And the other literature would say that if you've learned to do a new response to a particular context, if the context changes to some degree, that may change. I think it may not be as bad as that. Partly because a lot of what we're training people to respond to when we're training a new response as a habit to rumination is typically what we've ended up doing is the stimulus is an internal one. So it's how I'm physically feeling, it's a state of anxiety, it's a physiological sensation, it's a thought. And because that's internal, my sense is that may help it to generalize across situations because you're kind of walking around with it all the time with you. And that may mean that what's going on externally, contextually, may be slightly filtered through the fact that this is part of what your embodied experience. I mean, that's a hunch, but we need to test it. I think a lot of the work on habit change is focused on things that are environmental cues. And of course, an environmental cue can be affected quite a lot by other environmental cues.
I see. So that is very interesting. Thank you. I'm realizing I moved quickly to habit change and so on, but I think that I would like to focus a little bit more on the stimulus control piece of identifying the cues themselves, because I'm assuming that's a very important key piece of the clinical work. Could you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's critical to identify the cues. And I think that's another place where the sort of simple things we would do for functional analysis can be really potent. So the idea of doing an ABC, your antecedent behavior consequence, you take rumination as the behavior, and then you're trying to track what comes before that.
Yes.
And often, you know, there's going to be something happening in the world, so a situation, and then there will be some behavior by the client or other people around them, and then there will be some internal response, a thought or a feeling or a sensation. And what we'll be looking for is which of those comes before the rumination as part of a sort of sequence, part of a process. I mean, so a really good analogy to it that we're familiar to people who do cognitive behavior therapy is if you think about the model that the thing that you would do if you were investigating someone who was having panic attacks, you do a very fine-tuned, detailed analysis of what led up to the point when they were having the panic. So what was their thought, and then what effect did that have on their feeling, and then what did that have on their behavior, second by second, the sort of very detailed analysis of content to see the process of how it builds up. And we would do the same thing. We would ask people about their most recent examples of rumination. And we'd go through them second by second, as much detail as we can. You know, what happened then, and then what happened after that, and what did you notice, and what did you feel, and what did you think, until we could map out that sequence. And we'd do that for a couple of examples, and then start to see if there are any commonalities in terms of what was happening. So that would be one way we would try and spot those triggers. The other thing that, of course, we would do that's very helpful is getting people to do self-monitoring. So having diary records that people would complete between sessions, where they would again themselves note down when they ruminated and what was happening just beforehand. and that can be doubly useful, both as something to discuss in the session as a way of identifying those warning signs, but also, as we know with lots of habits, becoming more aware of them is quite an important step. And actually having people fill in records and do some self-monitoring is often quite powerful in that.
So self-monitoring as a strategy for increasing awareness of the cues.
Yes.
So let me shift a little bit, if that's okay, and ask you about cognitive restructuring. So your model suggests that cognitive restructuring is unlikely to be very helpful. Would you go so far as to say that it's contraindicated to treat rumination?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I think the argument would be that it's harder for cognitive restructuring to shift rumination. It can do so, but it can only do so under certain conditions.
Okay.
And that partly reflects the theoretical model, and it partly reflects our clinical experience. So, I mean, I did a lot of work at the beginning with people who were ruminating a lot, where I was taking a very traditional Beckian CBT approach, and it would help to some degree. But what we would find is often you could challenge one specific thought and do that really well together and see that that had changed. But then another thought would just come up. So there was something about, it's only just one thought in this whole process that people who ruminate a lot have. So just taking it one thought at a time didn't seem a particularly...
Oh yeah, I had a patient once, she described it as mental ping pong. You know, one thought comes up, we respond to it, then another one comes up, then we respond, but it just seems to go on and on. It doesn't really...
Yeah. And sometimes it's worse than that, because you get some patients, and this is partly a consequence, this is partly an interaction of a patient and possibly someone doing therapy less well, but you sometimes get the effect of, oh, I've challenged that negative thought, and then the patient goes, well, that's really obvious, why didn't I think of that before? And then they start getting into a ruminative train about beating themselves up that they should have been able to spot and change their negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got those two issues. I mean, it's kind of like, there's two metaphors. There's a metaphor that your thoughts are a chain, and if you just break one link in the chain, you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which if you did one good challenge might do that. But if you see the thoughts and rumination as kind of a flow of water, like a river or a waterfall, challenging one thought at a time is like stopping a drop of water.
Mm-hmm.
It's flowing on. So it seemed what we were trying to do was say, can we shift the flow? That doesn't mean we don't do thought challenging and we don't do Socratic questioning. It's not cognitive restructuring in the sense of we're looking at the accuracy or veridicality of thinking. But you will be doing, you'll be asking questions about the function or helpfulness of thinking, which is what you move to that kind of process level rather than that content level.
And would you say you might be asking questions, what helps me clinically, but tell me if I'm on track, is to ask questions about not just the function of any particular thought, but perhaps the function of the whole process, and to view the rumination as like a thing itself, as opposed to looking at each thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the sense, is that we could get stuck in thoughts. And it also reflects the fact that some people who ruminate really want to understand, they really want to understand every little thing that's happening. So it's almost you need to move away from the meaning and the content and say, look, there's this process happening here. Let's look at the overall process. And that's where we would track it. So we would ask quite detailed questions in the same way that you would often do if you were doing thought challenging, but rather than the detailed questions being there so that we can then go, okay, now let's see if this is an accurate representation. It's more like, can we see how the process unfolds and then look at where that person, what the effects of that are and where they could maybe do something differently.
Right, so what the effects of that are might help us start to identify what might be the function of this whole process.
So we don't actually, I mean, we wouldn't, you know, I don't think it's particularly productive to ask a patient what's the function of that thought or their thinking. It's more so if you do an antecedent behavior consequence kind of track of a sequence of rumination, you'll see, oh, well, the trigger to it was starting to feel a bit irritable. And then I started having all these thoughts about how I'm being oversensitive and I'm overreacting. And the consequence of that is I feel down, but I don't feel irritable anymore. And if you get a few examples of that, then you can kind of conceptualize it together and go, well, I wonder whether one of the things that might be happening here is that your rumination is something about controlling anger.
Right.
Even though it makes you feel terrible. And then if that makes sense to the patient and the few examples of that, then we can start thinking, okay, so the trigger is this sense of feeling irritable. Can we find an alternative behavior that you can do that helps you feel in control of anger? Have all the downside of beating yourself up about being oversensitive.
So then to begin to look at other strategies to reduce irritability, other strategies than rumination.
Yeah. Because the argument would be, then it slots neatly into the habit change because we can link it to the stimulus, in this case, starting to feel irritable, and it's naturally reinforcing to the person because it's kind of functionally equivalent to the rumination, but without the downside. So in that case, you might be teaching a combination of relaxation to deal with the physical effects of irritability, and possibly assertiveness. Because then you can actually go and deal with the situation that's causing the irritability. So, in a sense that we're very flexible, that we can use the full range of cognitive behavioral techniques, but the selection on them is based on how do they fit into that model of what's going to be most effective to replace the ruminative habit with a more functional alternative.
Yes, thank you. Could you say something about the difference between productive ruminative thought and unproductive ruminative thought? This particular example might help with that, but we'd like to hear more about that piece.
Yeah. So I guess, this comes back to the idea that you can have it's normal to think about something that hasn't gone your way or that was an unexpected surprise or where you were hoping to make progress on a goal and you haven't. And of course, these are the kind of events that happen to everybody. So, not getting a promotion or the end of a relationship or all sorts of things that might trigger rumination and trying to make sense of what happened and review what happened. The idea is that's normal and sometimes it seems to be helpful and sometimes it doesn't. And what we've been looking at is what might make that distinction. And one of the key things that seems to be important there is the way that people are thinking about the situation that's happened to them and the unresolved goal. So that if you're thinking about what happened in a very concrete and specific way, so you're paying attention to the detail of the situation and how it happened and the context of the sensory and perceptual details of who it was with and where it was and what was going on and how it unfolded over time, that seems to be much more helpful, both in emotional response but also sort of active problem solving than if you're thinking about the same situation in a much more kind of generalized and abstract way. So the classic example of that, which we see in depressive rumination, is something bad happens and the person sits there thinking, why did this happen? Or what does it mean about me? Why did this happen to me? Or why does this keep happening to me? A kind of clinical example would be I've seen this in a few clients. We've had someone who's depressed, who's a mother of younger or teenage children where they sometimes get into disagreements or arguments with the kids. Right, so they have a trigger to a bout of rumination might be having the kids misbehave or not being able to discipline the kids. And then that person will start thinking about, why is it so difficult? Why don't they do this? Why can't I get control? Why am I such a bad mother? And that will go on and on and on. So they move away from the discrete detail of the particular interaction. What does it mean about me and what's it going to mean? And I'll think about other situations where it's gone wrong and other things where it's not worked. So when we're trying to, but if it's been the same situation, the person stops and thinks about how did this happen, and replays the detail of the interaction. Well, they said this and then I said this and then this happened. And they also think about how can I do something about what can I do next. They often get a much more kind of constructive sense of the situation. It stays a bit more in perspective. And that's what we see both clinically and through a number of experimental studies, that if you shift people between these kind of why questions versus these how questions, or so, what questions, it makes a big difference.
Okay, so the less productive rumination would be why abstract type of questions, and the more productive rumination would tend to be what are the details of what happened and how did it happen, and those kinds of thinking would tend to lead to more productive thinking and problem solving.
Yeah, that's right. I mean. And what happens with those why questions is they move away from the detail of the situation and they kind of decontextualize it. So that feeds into the kind of generalizing that we see in depression, whereas the how questions tend to ground it more in the context, which helps keep it in perspective, but also generates potential options for doing something different, because it becomes about behavior. What could I do differently? Rather than, oh, there's something, this is something wrong with me or something wrong with the world. Right.
So now part of the interventions you've been doing in your therapy involve concreteness training. How do you do that exactly with your patient? Is this, I assume it's pretty close to what we've just talked about, but is there anything else involved in concreteness training?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to that. So we would be emphasizing all of those elements about paying attention to the detail of the situation, the context, sensory, perceptual, and the sequence of what happened, and then how you can move forward. And usually it goes through a couple of phases. So what we often do is try and get some experience that illustrates experientially to people that there's a difference between these styles of thinking. So we'll do often we do a behavioral experiment where having talked through a couple of situations where someone ruminates, I'll have noted down the kind of questions they're asking themselves, their why questions or their meaning questions. And then we'll get them to imagine the situation again and prompt them with those questions and see how they feel and how they, you know, whether they're making active plans or not. And then we, as a second part of the experiment, we'll get them to imagine the same situation again. But this time I prompt them with some more of those how questions, like, so how did it happen? How can we do something about it? So, and then get them to rate again how they're feeling and how much they've made plans. And often, even just doing that, people in the session get a sense of, oh yeah, I'm actually being a bit more positive here, or I'm able to be a bit more active here. So we're giving a very quick indication in the experiment that there may be a shift between thinking. And that gives some motivation for them to go and then practice doing a more kind of formal version of that, where we spell out the elements and get them to practice it. And again, we often try and link that to the warning signs of cues to rumination or to difficult situations. So often we ask people to think, we might practice it in the session where we get people to recall a recent event that was a bit upsetting, not too upsetting, because it's easiest to practice it on a milder event to start with. And then practice going through and focusing on the details and talking through the sequence and thinking how they might do it. And there's a sort of, you know, standardized set of prompts that you might give people. You get them to practice that in the session, and then they would have a recording of that they could go off and practice.
And the recording would be of the prompts themselves to remind yourself to ask yourself.
Imagine the situation and then working through the prompts.
Imagine the situation. So in the session, you might have the person imagine a situation like, oh, I just had a disagreement with my teenage daughter.
Yeah.
And so now I'm going to walk through this particular set of prompts that Dr. Watkins just gave me. One is, let me focus on what happened, and let me focus on the details in time of what happened first, and then what happened second, and then what happened next. And I'm going to walk through all those. And then I'm going to ask myself, is there anything I could do? Would those be the kind of prompts
So noticing the detail of what was happening, and then noticing how did this happen, what was the, then how can I do something about it, how can I get started on doing something about it, those kinds of prompts. I mean, typically the first time we would do it, we'd get the person to describe the situation, so then the therapist can actually not just prompt generically, but prompt more specifically. So
yes.
If you know that it's the situation was an argument with a a teenage daughter, then you want to know, well, what did you say,
and
what
yes.
and how did you say it, and what was the tone of voice, and who, where did you say it, and all of those. So you could prompt them the first couple of times with a bit more detail, so they get a sense of what they're trying to get to. And then the other thing we would do in therapy is we keep coming back to that. So when someone's describing a situation, having introduced the distinction between being more concrete and being more abstract, you might actually say to someone, you're describing the situation, but it sounds to me like you're still talking about it in quite an abstract way. Can we try and get more detail from that? So we encourage therapists to keep sort of trying to drill down to more detail. And sort of the rule of thumb is, can you imagine, can you get a mental picture of what the person is telling you?
Yes, you talk about imagine it as if it was a movie. And yeah. So if your patient is talking to you about a situation where you cannot get any visual image or movie of what happened, then it's a kind of a cue to you and the patient, it's too abstract. Is that accurate?
Yeah, something like that. And also, can you get it down to the exact behavior? So, I mean, often people use terms that are already quite abstract. So they'll say, this person insulted me. Well, I have no idea what actually happened.
Right.
Did they say something? Did they make a gesture?
Right.
So then, then that's kind of a cue to say, okay, just tell me what actually happened. You want to be able to see the person's behaviors and other people's behaviors.
Ah, right. What were the behaviors? And it's true, I wouldn't be able to have a movie in my mind if the person said he insulted me. We would need to know the actual behaviors.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one final question, which is about assessment and measures. Would you recommend that clinicians use measures or scales to assess rumination? And would you recommend doing that as the therapy proceeds?
If you think that the rumination might be an issue, and often that's worth doing with certainly with patients who have depression and anxiety, it's probably a good idea to assess it. I mean, how much you use a score in a kind of formal way is kind of personal preference, I think. What can be quite useful is something like Susan's learning seamers response styles questionnaire, which asks lots of things about what do you do when you feel sat down or depressed. Like keep thinking things over, or that can be quite useful as a sort of jumping off point for a discussion with somebody, because if they're scoring quite high on that, and you can start saying, well, this looks like there's something that happens a lot with you, this tendency to think things over, and that can be a useful entry point, I think, to then thinking about rumination as something that person might do. And it's certainly been my experience that when you introduce the idea of rumination to patients with depression and anxiety, it makes a lot of sense for lots of them. And sometimes it's not something that they've kind of had discussed before. That actually is something that they kind of grab hold on to. Yeah, that really does describe me, and I think it would be really useful to focus in on that. So it can be useful in that kind of context in an assessment to kind of set the frame for what you do. As a measure, it's not really been designed as a clinical measure in terms of a change measure.
And here you're talking about Susan Nolan Hoeksema's response styles questionnaire.
Yeah, so the ruminative, it's actually technically the ruminative subscale of the response styles questionnaire. But yeah, I mean, it does change with symptom. It does change with the treatment. I mean, we've shown that in a couple of studies, and so have some other people. But I'm not sure it's the best clinical measure. I mean, what we've actually found it's been quite useful is a more ad hoc measure where you just get patients to report on a scale or on a line the frequency of their rumination, the duration, because sometimes they can have shorter or longer, what's the average duration, how much control they have over it, and how much it interrupts or interferes with other activities, because those seem to be clinically have been more sensitive for when we're doing interventions with people to pick up on those other changes.
I see. So you might then just develop an ad hoc scale where you're asking about frequency, and so you'd just be asking for an average count per day or something like that?
Or over the week.
How often did you ruminate? Duration, what was the average duration, or do you want maximum duration?
We typically would ask average and also the longest of the week.
Average duration of rumination over the week, and what was the longest time you spent ruminating? I wrote C. What was that other third thing? Oh, control.
Control.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How much control?
Out of 100, say, or out of 0 to 10 or 0 to 100, how much control did you have over it? And we've actually found that looked like that might be one of the more sensitive things that's changing, because sometimes the frequency and the duration don't change straight away, but people start saying, actually, I can stop and start it a bit more than I could.
Okay. So you might also ask for a degree of control, 0 to 10, that you had over the week, and you notice a change in that, perhaps earliest. And then you might also ask for a rating of to what 0 to 10 would you do? To what degree did rumination interrupt your life?
Or interfere with, you know, so this is kind of how much is it kind of causing a problem in a sense?
Interfering, right. Yeah. And would you rate that 0 to 10 also?
Yeah, that's something like that, similar.
Okay.
Because a lot of patients will say, yeah, you know, it is stopping me from doing things, or it's making me feel down, or it's impairing my sleep, or it's making me hard to concentrate at work.
Right. Beautiful. Thank you. So let me see us as coming to the end here, Ed, and let me ask you, is there any final topic that you would view as critical that we haven't talked about here that clinicians should be thinking about if they're going to start attending to rumination in their patients and starting to learn from you about intervening to treat it?
I think we've covered most of the key things about, you know, spotting the triggers and the context, and then practicing a habitual response to learn a new response to that, and how that can emerge from functional analysis. I guess the more general thing that might maybe worth thinking about, because we've really talked about this in the context of depression mainly, is, and that's where most of my work has been done, but theoretically and increasingly the evidence suggests that a lot of these ideas could be relevant in other presentations, particularly those where we get comorbidity. I mean, as we know, anxiety and depression are pretty comorbid, and there's probably good reasons for thinking that worry and rumination are pretty closely intertwined. So if you're targeting one, you're probably targeting the other. But that's one place I think this work might be relevant, and I easily adapted to that.
Yes.
The approach, but it may apply to other areas as well. I mean, we're knowing that we're seeing rumination as a risk factor or a maintaining factor in other disorders, so PTSD, it's presenting in psychosis, possibly in eating disorders as well. So it may well be that this might be a useful adjunct to existing interventions where rumination sort of becomes a barrier to progress, because I think that's often what we find is that because it's such an automatic habit and it's hard to control, and because it is itself interfering, because it occupies mental space, exacerbates negative emotion, and
yeah,
so on. I think that's one of the reasons why the data does seem to suggest that not only is rumination something that's involved in the maintenance of emotional disorders, but may actually be a barrier to the therapeutic change sometimes. So where it is popping up in patients, it might be worth identifying it and then trying to tackle it, so that you can then get onto the other aspects of change that you're trying to achieve, whether that's exposure or teaching other skills or.
Yes. So yes, I agree. So here we're highlighting the transdiagnostic nature of rumination, and you're also suggesting at the very end that, you know, if you're a clinician who's got a patient who's not making progress, it might be worthwhile to go in there and look and see if rumination might be a barrier that, yeah, if targeted, could help this person make progress. I have found that in more than one of my depressed patients.
And I think that's right, and I think it can apply in a number of ways. So we've got some quite interesting examples from when we were working with depression, and we would do activity scheduling. So you have people make a plan to go and re-engage in some previously positive activity, whether it's playing a musical instrument or seeing friends or exercise. And they'd come back the next week and they've done the plan.
Yep.
So they're yeah, Doc, I've done the plan, but I don't feel any better.
I didn't get any enjoyment.
And then you review it, and what you would see is that all the way through this activity, they've got a running commentary. Oh, well, this isn't as good as it used to be. I'm not doing this as well. They're ruminating as they're doing it. So it completely blocks out any of the reinforcing benefits of it. So it can be a block there. And I think the same thing can happen when you're doing exposure work. If someone's trying to be exposed to a situation, but all they're doing is ruminating about it.
Yeah.
It just blocks out any learning that can occur. So if it is happening at a quite a high rate, it can easily prevent all the other things that might work from having their best impact. So I think and we're starting to do some work with some colleagues to look at some of those things. So can we target rumination to improve interventions for PTSD, for example? Because we know that rumination is one of the big predictors of both risk for PTSD if you ruminate about the trauma. It might be one of the key things that needs to change for people to actually recover from the trauma. So.
Yes, that makes sense. Thank you, Ed, very much for your time and your obvious expertise in this area. So helpful. I'm learning a lot myself, and we're looking forward to disseminating these ideas to clinicians worldwide. So let me ask those of you who are listening again to remind you to, when you finish listening, which will happen in 1 second, please go and do our little survey and give us some feedback about what you got liked or didn't like about this interview. So let me again thank you, Ed. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate all the many years of work you've done to build these new ideas and help us as clinicians be more effective with our ruminators. So it's a very nice contribution, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Jackie. It's been fun talking to you.
Beautiful. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you.